This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. This week is episode 2 of our quarterly co-host. So let's jump into the intro and I'll tell you some more about it.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution and one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviours.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding Safety, crushing a stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Blue. What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety is the YouTube channel and podcast doing exactly what it says on the tin. We're to change the perception of health and safety. We do that here on YouTube and we do that on the podcast as well. So if you're here, hit that subscribe button, all the bells and whistles and buttons that do magical algorithm-y things to get me in other people's ear holes and faces. So today's episode is... She's back again. Laura is our quarterly co-host. Laura Alcott from the HSC Recruitment Network is our quarterly co-host. And me and Laura are talking to, Laura and I are talking to CEOs, operational directors. And today we're talking to the MD of a trade association. Trade association? What is that, you might say? Well, I work for a trade association in a day, and a trade association is exactly what it says on the tin. Members are companies that work within that trade or that profession or that industry, and they join the association, and that association guides them, supports them, talks to the government for them, and so on and so forth. It's a very, very interesting thing, and honestly, I think they're undervalued in the UK. And I think they've got massive, massive potential. So if you're not part of one and you're running a business or you're a safety professional within your business, I strongly advise you to start engaging with your trade association. So without further ado, let's jump into the intro. I'm going to let Laura introduce herself and the guest today. And we'll get chatting about what safety looks like through the eyes of a CEO of a trade association. But before we do that, a quick message from our sponsors. So... Project Miletium, don't forget to check them out. It's my company. It's all about professional development for the safety and risk profession. A mix of weekly calls, monthly book clubs, and a quarterly wagon wheel, which is essentially a mastermind event of keynotes and workshops and the like. Our customers at the moment are absolutely loving it. The community is really starting to thrive, and we've been only going 3 months. So don't miss this opportunity. It is just, I knew it was going to be good because when me and Colin from the Interest in Safety podcast put this together, we were like, yes, this is what the industry has been missing. Some support, some cognitive diversity, a community together, sorting each other out, helping each other solve problems, helping each other innovate, helping connect with what's out there. It's basically a massive brain. It's a mastermind. We knew it was going to be good, but the feedback we're getting off members are telling us that they wouldn't have been able to do what they're doing now if it wasn't for Project Miletium, even within the first 3 months. It's members are telling us this is the best thing they've had in 10 years of being in a profession. Members are telling us that they'd lost their passion for health and safety, and this community has helped them find their passion again. Ah, it makes me so happy to hear these words. One of my favourite feedback we get from members is it groundbreaking? I don't know yet, but it's definitely not full of knobheads. Great. Great feedback. So if you're thinking it's for you, go to www.projectmiletium.com. I'll put a link in the description, or you can message me or email me, james@rebrandingsafety.com, and I'll get you on a call for free, or DM me on LinkedIn and I'll get you on a call for free. And finally, one last note from our sponsor of Rebranding Safety YouTube and podcast is Paradigm Human Performance HSC subscription service. Their HSC subscription service is perfect for that SME that's spinning those plates all the time and they're looking for some more support. They don't want health and safety to be seen as an unaffordable luxury. They don't want establishing a foundation of legal, regulatory and industry compliance out of reach for the employer. Paradigm Human Performance's global mission is to make the workplace healthier, safer, more respectful places where employees are recognized for their contribution and their subject matter expertise. So if you want to make worker safety the DNA of your organization, a great way to make this reality is Paradigm's HSC subscription service. So go check them out. I've got all the emails, phone numbers in the description below. Or if you're not sure, you can go to their website and check out their webinar first so that you can go to their weekly webinar. You can see the team. You can get a sense for them. You can start to see they really do know what they're talking about before you buy it. So try it before you buy it. Great option. And for me, you know, I wholly endorse what Paradigm are doing. You know, Teresa, the founder of Paradigm, she's pretty much involved in everything I do. You know, I absolutely love the lady, and the whole team are just absolutely outstanding, and they're growing and growing and growing like mad. And the best is, these guys are HOP experts. They're human and organizational experts. So this is not the kind of compliance service that you have to unlearn or declutter in 5 years, 10 years time. This is already decluttered. It's already streamlined. It's already got HOP at the core, at the nucleus of what it does. Listen to the way they talk about it, having worker safety as part of the DNA. So this is not something you're going to have to tear apart in a few years because you've just been on a HOP webinar or something like that. So hopefully that makes sense to you. Hopefully it will help you out. I really do think it will. And we wholly support what they do. Otherwise, we wouldn't have partnered with them. So go check out their details in the description below. But otherwise, let's jump into the episode of The Quarterly Co-host with Laura Orcott, episode 2.
This comes. Right. Thank you both. Welcome to the podcast, both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Laura, do you want to get straight into it and give yourself an introduction as the quarterly co-host and then introduce our guest for the day as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. So thanks for having me back, James. Clearly didn't scare you off the first time, which is good. For anyone that doesn't know me, I'm Laura. I'm an associate director at HSE Recruitment. I won't bore you with all the sales talk. It does what it says on the tin. We're a safety recruitment company. One of the things we're really, really passionate about is trying to make health and safety better as an industry. And the way that we want to do that is by helping with CPD, you know, putting on roundtables, doing podcasts, all this sort of fun stuff that can really help your professional development. So what I wanted to do with this quarterly co-hosting is look at health and safety from a different angle and look at the challenges that businesses face and C-suite professionals face. The reason I think that's really, really important is, health and safety people, we've absolutely got leadership skills in spades, but for some reason we don't seem to necessarily climb the ladder all the way up to board, into CEO, COO positions, whereas, you know, other professions seem to lend themselves more to that. So I think if we're going to help make health and safety better, we need to really understand business. We need to really understand challenges. We've got to be more commercial. And the only way we're going to do that is by talking to people who do that job. So Richard has very, very kindly agreed to come and have a chat to us today. I will let Richard introduce himself. Richard, though, is CEO of the Frozen Food Federation. So I hope you're making notes, James, as you're a federation employee as yourself, aren't you? So, Richard, do you want to tell us a bit about yourself?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for inviting me along. My background's quite varied, actually. Whilst at the moment I'm a CEO of it's the British Frozen Food Federation, which is always important to point out. But I really started my career in a serious way. I was the CEO of a frozen pizza business here in the UK. It was a German-based business. And I would basically set it up 1994 from, it was almost scratch. And it was a really interesting role because it was very much multifaceted. We were a relatively small operation here in the UK. We ended up, by the time I left, we had about 12 employees, but we did an immense turnover. And because of the role, you were very much a multidisciplinary. You know, you had to do a little bit of marketing. You had to do a little bit of distribution and logistics, PR, you know, the whole thing. And what it gave you was a real sort of good rounded overview of the way a business runs. Mm-hmm. And the Germans were always very keen on understanding the numbers. So you had to be really on top of your financials as well. yeah. And it was a great business to work for. We were the business now is the largest producer of private label frozen pizzas in the world. I think they produce something like 3 million pizzas a day.
Wow.
Across the different operations. So they've got four or five factories in Germany. They've got one in Austria. They've got several in America. And they've got a chilled operation here in the UK. And in fact, I was a non-exec director in the UK business as well, which gave me, I think, quite a unique insight to see the way a UK business run, a way a German business run, and how a business in between the two ran. So it was quite interesting. And in fact, I'd actually say one of the most interesting things was the difference in attitude around health and safety. As a non-executive at Stateside, which was our sister company, we obviously had monthly board reports, and an integral part of that was the health and safety report. Obviously, for you running a couple of factories, you had to make certain that staff were safe. There was lots of machinery. There was lots of movement of forklift trucks and lorries and things like that. And it was very interesting to see the different way the Germans approached health and safety to the way the Brits did. And we were much more about legislation and much more about having health and safety people in overseeing what was happening, whereas the German factories took much more of a personal responsibility role.
And
whilst there was legislation around it, and they took it very seriously, there were some very slight differences and slight nuances, which were really quite interesting. So my background is pretty varied. I was with the pizza business for 22 years. I'm involved in all sorts of areas of the pizza industry. Mm-hmm. And I was also involved with the British Frozen Food Federation, both as a member and as a supporter of the federation over many years. Also, as part of my role within the pizza industry, I was also involved in PAPA, which is the Pizza, Pasta and Italian Fine Food Association. And I've sat as a member of their management board now for something like 14, 15 years. And in fact, I was their first chairman. And we used to represent the industry in discussions with people like Public Health England.
Right, yeah.
Around salt targets. And in fact, I was one of the lead on negotiating and discussing with Department of Health on salt targets stretching way back 2006 when they first come out. So I got to a point in Freiburger. I got to my just before my 60th birthday. They offered me the opportunity to take early retirement, which I did. I then ran my own small consultancy business for a couple of years. And then I was approached in late 2018 by the British Frozen Food Federation to come in as their CEO, which I started in March of 2019. And I've basically been there for 2 years.
Got
great experience. And one of our real key strengths in the federation is health and safety.
Good to hear that.
I definitely had to learn how to run a federation. I still don't think I understand it fully, but I've got a really, really good team around me, and they are very supportive. And we've been making quite a few changes over the last sort of 2 years. Obviously, the first year was learning, setting a new strategy, but then the last year has basically been dealing with COVID. That's me.
Good. Well, really good overview. So basically, if it's pizza, pasta, or if it's frozen,
yep,
you're the man. You know it.
Absolutely.
Well, that was a really helpful overview. Thank you. I appreciate you sort of walking us through that, because like you said, yeah, it is quite a varied background, and you've worn many different hats, but you've definitely been working at C-suite level for a number of years, haven't you, to quite a senior level. So one of the things I think that we do struggle with in health and safety is just understanding that board level, understanding the complexities of it, understanding, you know, what things are important to them, what things, you know, make a business tick. And a huge push that we're doing at the moment is we're really, really pushing on soft skills and leadership development and things like that in the safety world. So from your experience, do you think there are particular skills that you need to work to that sort of senior level to be a C-suite professional? What would stand out for you?
I think probably one of the key things is the soft skills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you've got to believe that if someone gets to a senior position where they're being considered for a board position, they're probably fairly competent at the health and safety role. They probably know how to deliver that bit. You would think so, that they probably understand the legislation. They would understand, you know, how to put that in place within any business. But I think where they then need to get to is they need to have that ability to communicate that at a number of different levels.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about talking to the other departments in a business so that they understand. I suppose what it comes down to really is quite often health and safety can be seen to be a blocker. It's the thing that you have to do in order to satisfy the health and safety manager. Whereas what I think they should be doing is to try and explain the value that they can add to a business.
Mm-hmm.
And it is clear that they can add value to the business. I mean, if you think about these days, one of the key topics around the health and safety world is talking about the mental health of employees.
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, I think for a long time, we've always talked about health and safety being about, you know, safeguarding people for large bits of kit that might fall in them or, you know, machinery that might trap them. But more and more, we're beginning to see that actually health and safety people need to look at the workforce in a more holistic way. It's not mm-hmm. just about making certain they don't trap their fingers or get run over by a forklift truck. They've also got to try and understand, you know, what their mental attitudes are. And that's particularly important over the last 12 months with COVID. A lot of people working from home, you know, a lot of stress. I mean, there's a lot of businesses, even if the business has actually continued to operate, they may have actually reduced their workforce, which basically means that those that are left working are actually under more pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And that does have impacts on people's, you know, state of mind. And so I think it's that sort of thing that health professionals can start to explain, that actually what they do is for the benefit of the whole business. It's not just about, you know, saving someone from being run over by that forklift truck.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I do think that sort of communication skill is really important for them.
Yeah, I think you're preaching to the converted here with that, Richard. I mean, I know James will have loads to say on the perception of health and safety as a blocker and changing that perception. That's pretty much the entirety of what this podcast is for, isn't it, James? About changing that brand, changing the way that we're perceived in the marketplace.
Yeah, definitely. And to your point, Richard, it comes through action, really. I think I can't remember where I saw it, but the kind of be the change you want to see. For me, I think it's just it's positive to hear that message from yourself, in that for the listeners that potentially are working on that stuff and developing those skills, because we are, to Laura's point, talking about this all the time now. And, you know, there's even a debate within the profession as to, you know, which is more important, and are we actually trained to have those kind of skills? Because it would be a fair challenge to say, I think, that they're not necessarily skills just for a director of safety. I would probably say they're skills for a safety professional, regardless of where you are, because we're so vital.
I wouldn't disagree with you, James.
Yeah.
I think more and more it's about communication, what the role is across all levels of the business. And I do wonder whether there is that opportunity. I mean, I did listen to one of your earlier podcasts, and it was about how safety professionals change the way that they are perceived.
Mm.
And I do think, you know, if you actually start to help something that's very visible in terms of your workforce, I do believe that's an opportunity to change perception about what health and safety is. Because, you know, up until, I mean, I keep talking about, you know, being run over by a forklift truck because, you know, it's a very visible thing, isn't it? But of course, that only happens every so often. You know, when the health and safety professional comes into their own is when something goes wrong and they're there and they can prove that all the right things have been done and that they make certain all the training's been done. And it's only then you sort of go, well, actually, yeah, that they're worth their weight in gold. But if you can actually see that more visibly on a day-to-day basis about the way they're helping employees, I think it has an opportunity to change the way that health and safety professionals are seen by industry, mm-hmm. that they're actually more of an integral part of running a business mm-hmm. as opposed to just being there when it all goes wrong.
Yeah.
Or being there to stop it going wrong, I suppose, is the better way to put it.
Do you think, Richard, like working for a trade association, are the requirements of a safety professional different than say if you worked for a corporate company? I am the head of safety for a trade association, and actually some of the stuff we are doing, conversations with government, lobbying government, you know, I'm in a much more kind of long-term strategic mind as to, I need to understand my members from a holistic point of view, like why they might make that decision or how to influence them. But, you know, things like lobbying government, Jesus, you know, I've never done that in my entire career. And all of a sudden we're writing letters to the government. And it's just like, whoa, this is interesting. Is it different or is it the same? Well,
absolutely. I mean, in fact, one of the skills of my lead on health and safety, a guy called Simon Brentnell, is he's actually a pretty good communicator.
Mm.
You know, and in fact, he's a very quick learner as well. Yeah. I mean, so obviously through this year, we've had to change to doing much more things by Zoom and Teams meetings and that. And Simon has come on leaps and bounds in the way he presents and the way he talks. So I think he absolutely gets it that you've got to communicate in a different way, and he's very good at it. I think you all understand, you know, health and safety at times can be a pretty dry subject. I mean, it's almost akin to presenting on accounting, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
but he can actually bring it to life, and he's really good at bringing practical examples. So he did a really good thing. I mean, even before we got into COVID, we ran a special seminar, which was a hands-on seminar about composite panels.
Mm-hmm.
And what he did was he worked with Lincolnshire Fire and Rescue, and they actually got a composite panel into a yard and set fire to it for a group of people to actually see what it did.
Yeah.
And it was a real practical example. If you don't do things right, just how critical it could be for you. And he's really good at getting those practical demonstrations for people.
Yeah.
I think the role of health and safety in a federation, James, is fundamentally different.
Yeah.
You are trying to educate your membership. You're trying to educate them. You're trying to support them. And you're right. You have to have a longer term view.
Yeah. It's kind of like, when I look at it from my own experiences, I've only been in the trade association for, I started in July last year. So, you know, coming up on a year in a few months, but already it's kind of like those influencing skills that I've developed over my career, it's that on steroids, because how we're trying to kind of influence our members, who, you know, my trade association is the entire supply chain. So I'm talking to some serious heavy manufacturing to kind of mid-range manufacturing and then sole traders in a way. And it's really interesting to kind of understand the different dynamics of all those different companies. But then us as the trade association have very little power, really, whereas in a company, I might have a bit of power to be able to support me. Whereas here it's all about, you hit the nail on the head, Richard, I think, is it's education. You know, it's education, education, education. For me, that's all we can do as you keep getting the information out. So I think it is kind of different to a point in that it's maybe what we would do originally, but maybe a bit more challenging because everything's kind of, to my point, on steroids.
I also think it's about looking for the future. You need to look, you know, part of the problem with so many health and safety professionals that are embedded in a business, it sometimes, you know, it's difficult to get past the cold face. You know, you're just there, you know, doing your day-to-day work and making sure that it works. And sometimes it's difficult to be able to look towards the horizon. And I think that's one of the roles that a federation can play. It can help raise people's view that says, look, this is what's coming. And we're also pretty good, I think, at taking what might be a problem for a particular member and getting a collaborative approach. And that works really well. You know, that really is a great way to bring things together. And that's one of the strengths of our federation. I'm sure yours as well, James, is actually bringing people together so that they talk to one another. And then you actually get some amazing results out of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think, you know, that's a real key attribute of good communication.
I was quite interested in something you both kind of touched on there, in that, Richard, you mentioned how Simon has sort of come on over the past year with communication and things like that. James, you said, you know, your influence and skills have developed, and COVID's been a big part of this. It you know, it's thrown health and safety into the forefront in a lot of companies. One thing I've always been interested in is whether we think these soft skills, you know, the leadership, the communication, are they things that are innate in us? Are they things that we can develop, that we can learn? Richard, do you think you've always had that skill set, or is that something you've built?
I've always been known as a bit of a gobby bugger. I do think you can learn those skills. Laura, I don't think, you know, good communication is not the, you know, you're not born with it. You can learn it. There are certain things that you learn, how to communicate to people. Of course people can learn it. And I think it's important that if you're a professional in a certain area, that you must communicate with, let's say, your fellow, your colleagues and your directors. So, you know, if you're in a business, everyone works in a certain discipline. So whether you're in marketing, whether you're in accountancy, whether you're in ops, but business will only work if you all communicate together.
Yeah.
you can't work in silos. Silos don't work. You have to communicate. So I actually think it's almost a prerequisite skill. As you go up the chain, the more and more you go, the more and more you have to communicate. And I take a James earlier point that it's, you know, good communication is not the sole province of C-suite. It should all be all the way through the business. Mm-hmm. And the more you communicate, the better people will understand, you know, what the challenges are, how you can actually improve the business, how you can enable them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we're also seeing, we've got to communicate in different ways. So if you think about us getting a health and safety message across to a 24 and 25 year old, it is fundamentally different to getting it across to a 55 year old.
Yeah, right? Completely.
They want to absorb it in a totally different way. And we're seeing more and more people using, you know, mobile apps for people to do training on. And, you know, okay, the 55-year-old might not accept it, but sure as hell, the 25-year-old will only want to do it that way. That's the only way you'll really get to them. And I think that's also a challenge, especially for the more senior C-suite people, where they've suddenly got to adopt, you know, new methods of communication. And some do it readily. Others find it a bit more of a challenge. But, you know, you've definitely got to embrace that. And I suppose it's not a lot different from things like automation coming into a business. You know,
if you're a
board director and your ops manager comes in and says, look, you know, we're going to put automatic palletization in. You don't sit there and go, well, no, I don't like technology. You know, you just go, oh, fantastic. You know, you're about to drive a huge amount of cost out of their business. But it's the same way, you know, with a health safety director saying, look, we need to communicate with our employees in a different way.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just a similar challenge.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And it's a really easy thing to forget those differences in communication, because we've definitely been guilty of it ourselves. You know, as recruiters, we've been around for decades. We do things in the same way. We got to a point where, you're putting adverts out, you're trying to attract new, exciting people, and they're not attracted by the traditional job description and the bullet points. And you've got to speak to them in their sort of language. I completely agree. I think that's a really important point. Sorry, James, go ahead.
Oh, you go.
I was just going to ask you, if you found the same.
I think to Richard's point, I think a real key thing here is understanding the diverse nature of these skills. Mm. And I think that there's two points to that. One, I think some people have inherent traits in themselves that make the softer skills really easy. Some people are naturally better communicators than others, and some people are naturally not great communicators, but that normally means they're better at something else. So you get those people who are like, unbelievably academic, really intelligent, stereotypically horrendous communicators. you've seen someone like Chris Whitty who fits that stereotype, but then becomes an unbelievable communicator. And there's another lady who we saw a lot through COVID. I can't remember her name, but she, from my opinion, was outstanding. One of the best communicators I've ever seen, especially someone that can take a very complex message and make it very simple or very layman terms, so to speak. But I think for us as maybe leaders, if we're employing, or yourself, especially Laura, I think that the point is that, yes, I think we can teach it. Yes, I think it can take time. But I do think we can teach it, but inherently we can't remove the fact that it's harder for some people than it is for other people. So for me, it's acknowledging that and saying, okay, this person struggles with good communication or whatever we think, maybe it's not good, maybe it's bad, maybe putting a value on it is not the right way to look at it. But I think acknowledging that it's challenging for some people and not for others, and means that we can then deal with it. I think a lot of the time we go, oh, okay, cool, yeah, let's do the soft skills. Yeah, let's get these soft skills. These are really important. We need to all focus on the soft skills. But you look at some of the soft skills, they're kind of like, a lot of times they're called relational skills or relationship skills. Yeah. You talk about having empathy and being caring. They're inherently female traits. So for males, it's kind of genetically or stereotypically speaking, a bit harder for us to do that. So, are we going to start seeing an influx of women into the safety profession? Well, hopefully, because we could do have a bit of diversity. But
weirdly, we actually already are. Awesome. That's something I've already noticed, is the shift in diversity recently. Yeah. I think the last four or five shortlists that I've been doing, we've had a disproportionate amount of women, which we've never seen before. So it's definitely turning that way.
I would disagree with you, though, James. I don't think that. It's a gender thing. I've seen some fantastic presenters that are female. I've seen some terrible presenters that are female. I've seen exactly the same for males. Those that are good at what they talk about, sometimes, yes, they've been trained to do it. And you're also right, some people have a natural skill at doing it. But I do think if you're bad at it, you can still be trained to be better.
Definitely.
Yeah.
You can definitely improve what you do. And you asked me, the start of this was how do you get to be a C-suite and you're a health and safety professional? Well, to me, make sense you're a good communicator, because you need to explain why you do things and how you can benefit the company. I think we're straying into the point of how do you make everyone a better communicator. Well, you're never going to do that. And what you're going to do is you're going to get the good health and safety professionals who are the good communicators, whether they be male or female, will make it onto boards.
That is
the reality of life.
Yeah,
and the ones that don't get there might well be very competent what they do, but just not very good at explaining it to their colleagues and their fellow directors.
Yeah, it's a good point. It goes kind of hand in hand with a lot of the stuff I talk about safety professionals branding themselves. Yeah. In that, not everybody loves social media. Not everybody is going to be able to do this. Yeah. But if you want to climb the ladder, unfortunately, you just have to. Yeah. you just have to get good at it.
I would actually argue I'm actually a really good example of someone who's actually a reasonable communicator, and it's helped me climb the ladder. So I left school with absolutely diddly squat qualifications.
Oh, really?
Absolutely nothing. And I met someone in my business career who was quite inspirational and quite motivational. And he suggested I should really go and get some education. So I did night school. So I did about 5 years of night school to learn some of the basics. And then because I'm actually quite good at talking to people and I had that little bit of knowledge as well, and then I actually was in the right place at the right time several occasions, it just helped me progress. I do think communications is a really important area.
I want to come back on one of the points you made earlier. Firstly, don't apologise for disagreeing with me. I love it when people disagree with me. That sparks a good conversation.
My mum and dad brought me up to be polite.
but I think maybe I didn't explain myself very well before, but that sounds very passive aggressive. I didn't mean it like that. It sounds like I've wrote an email. Maybe
James, very well. James, I spent 20 years dealing with retail buyers. I can tell you, you will not sound aggressive to me in any way, shape, or form.
Passively.
passively or overtly.
So I think my point was actually not that somebody couldn't get it. I think everyone can develop. I think everyone can do anything. In my general, it depends on whether you put yourself to it, put the work into it. I think that if you've seen enough crazy stories out there that you think, how did that man or woman or person, disabled person, do that? They just had the right positive mental attitude and a determination to do it. So I think, to your question, Laura, I think everybody can develop the skills. I think what we have to acknowledge is that we are diverse. There is no one size fit all. And some people find communication or having empathy or building relationships or there's any of those softer skills more challenging than other people. And one example would be the fact that a lot of them are female traits and male traits. But to your point, Richard, 100%, I technically have male traits, but they were smashed out of me because I was raised by women. I'm much more that all of that stuff really suits me and it works for me because that's how I was raised. So I think, but my kind of other point around diversity actually is again, when we communicate stuff out to both of your points, it's not a one size fit all again. So you've seen recruitment, Laura, which is you've kind of alluded to, which is absolutely amazing, doing videos. So there's loads of them now doing a video.
They all copied me, James. I started it.
Well, I didn't want to say it. I think you were the first one, but I'm sure if I say that, somebody will message me and say, no, I was the first one. You were definitely the first one I saw. And then after that, there was a flood, which I like. I really, really like. But I think it's also acknowledging, to Richard's point, that some people can't stand that either.
Yeah.
Some people are still, whether that's, and again, the same one's good or bad is not the point. It's like, how have we traditionally communicated safety out for years has been written for so long. Everything's written, management system, risk assessment, blah, 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 all written. And that's not been a problem for a long time. Now our cultures are becoming a lot more diverse. There's a lot more people in our country that are English is a second, third, fourth, fifth language, and it's just that's really challenging to read these complex safety documents. But if we look back at how, when I remember I've been a trainer for many years, and when I was first trained as a trainer, one of the first thing they tell you is there are several different learning types. There are kinetic learners, there are audio learners, there are visual, and there are reading learners, or whatever they're called, right? But yeah, in safety or in a lot of business communications, we only cater to one of those because like, why are risk assessments not communicated out by video? Why don't companies have podcasts? Why don't companies have more conversations with each other, more workshops? So your example, Richard, your safety professional got that composite panel and set it on fire. Yeah. You know, that is just utilizing good techniques and diverse techniques to be able to say, here's one way of learning and here's one way of communicating a message out. It doesn't mean that you also type that up in a report and send it out for the people that just love to read stuff.
Yeah.
So for me, a lot of this stuff is about looking at this and going, it's not one size fits all. My concern around this soft skills and the move towards digitalization is we also forget the people that don't like that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and for my, you're probably experiencing this as well, Richard. I don't know if you're anything like my trade associations. We used to have loads of meetings, loads of members meetings, regional meetings, you know, safety committees, executive committees, a lot, all gone onto Zoom. Some of those groups, regions, committees, loving it. Some of them are like, oh my God, I can do 7, 10, 15 meetings a day and I'm not spending hours and hours on the road. Whereas before, one GGF meeting would take me, you know, all day, for example. Some of them can't stand it and they cannot wait to get back face to face. So again, when we're having these conversations, should we go back to face to face? For me, it's like, it's not one size fits all. It's we need to work out, and my boss kind of nailed it. It's like, if we're going to have a hotel kind of conference room, it's a hotel conference room, but it must have video conferencing as well. So we're not forcing everyone to travel. So I think that's just one example of kind of just being diverse. And I think
the challenge. I think the challenge there, James, will be how do you get the people that are joining electronically to engage as well as the people that are there physically? Yeah.
When you're all
digital, when you're there physically, then everyone can join in. Yeah. And in fact, if you're the chair and you see someone who's not engaging, you can pull them in.
Yeah.
And I personally find that very difficult on Zoom meetings because sometimes you can't see everyone.
Yeah.
And so you rely upon them to actually engage. I mean, I've had a couple of interesting experiences. I launched in August of last year a special interest group on packaging reduction. And originally I wanted to do it as a physical meeting. And I think we had about 34 people joining the meeting. And I did like a first 30-minute presentation on why I thought it was a good idea, what the background was, and then I went, right, and I'd like comments now. Well, you just heard the bloody crickets. I mean, it was awful. And whereas if you'd have been in a room, you could have seen people's body language. You could have said to someone, you know, come on. Anyway, I fortunately knew a few people on the call, and I managed to bring them in. But it was very difficult. But having said that, I think in a way, James, you're right. I think what we're going to do is from COVID, we're going to go to a mix. We'll go to a mixture of physical meetings, online meetings. I think COVID has accelerated this. What was already starting to happen, but it's just accelerated. We probably moved forward 10 or 15 years in case of 12
absolutely.
Months. Is my view. It's just coming back to one of the points you made, though, about the one size doesn't fit all. I think what we ought to think about as well is that it sometimes depends what sort of industry a health and safety professional is in to see what their standing is and how they need to react. So I would imagine that a health and safety professional in a heavy steel industry or a heavy industry probably needs to communicate differently to someone who's perhaps in a food factory.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head.
Because obviously the risk, but you know, the risk in a heavy industry are far greater than they would be in a food factory. Mm. No less important for either place, but the standing of the health and safety professional in the heavy industry would be quite different to one in a food factory.
Yeah,
and that's the nature of the business.
I think that's such a good point. Yeah, such a good point because we are. And this is not a criticism at recruitment before I continue on. Laura.
Hey, whoa, what are you about to say?
This is not a criticism of any particular recruitment company, but we are quite bad, I think, in our industry of saying, right, I work in manufacturing, I'm employing a safety person for manufacturing. You must have 100 years experience in manufacturing.
Yeah, 100%.
If you have ever worked anywhere else, you are a bad safety professional and I don't want you. But actually, like, and I've struggled with that personally because I actually have a really diverse background. Like, I started in manufacturing and then I've been in healthcare, housing, now I'm in construction and manufacturing. Turns out the diversity of my career has helped me because we're really diverse at GGF. But my point being is that I actually think my soft skills, particularly communication, have developed more because I've had a really diverse background, because how I communicated in manufacturing, very much lads, kind of like a construction site, heavy industry kind of manufacturing, all male, like, yeah, do you know what I mean? Like, not very much a modern workplace, I will say that. It's, you're kind of wolf whistles and stuff like, not, I'm not proud of it, all right? But it was the one way
you're
to communicate.
You're not a wolf whistler, James, that's disgraceful.
I wasn't then.
No, he meant when he walked past.
Yeah. Thank you for acknowledging that, Richard. Thank you for picking that up. But that was the kind of environment. Do you know what I mean? It was that real stereotypical lads environment. And that was how I was taught to communicate in manufacturing. And then I go and get a job in healthcare. And it's like, oh hell no, you can't communicate like that in healthcare. Do you know what I mean? Very different. And then I realized, I was really lucky when I worked in the NHS, but to cover so many different areas, and then realize, oh Jesus, this is actually the different regional ways to communicate as well. And then end up in a national role in a housing association, and I'm like, Jesus, there's even north south different ways to communicate. So diversity is a really good thing, and I think exposure to these things is really, really interesting. And I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Richard. I think that it's really interesting when you see different industries, different cultures, different regions, all of these people have different nuances and sometimes very, not nuances, sometimes seriously different ways of communicating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing to have a real diverse background. I think it's a bonus, in my opinion. Yeah. But I'd be interested in your opinion, Laura, as a recruiter.
Well, this is why I like talking to you, James, because we do think along the same sort of lines. I completely agree with you. For the exact reasons you said, the reason diversity is a big thing is that you get different perspectives. So why would that not be the same for diverse industries? You get different perspectives from the different areas you've been in. Unfortunately, our hands are often tied by clients. Manufacturing companies in particular love people from manufacturing. That's it. And we can talk to them about diverse backgrounds and how that builds your soft skills and your communication till the cows come home. But sometimes you are banging your head against a brick wall. But yeah, 100% agree with you. I don't see why, if you're, you know, just because you're a manufacturing company, you must have someone from a manufacturing environment. If they are a good, technically competent safety person, they'll be able to apply the legislation and the things they've learned and the approach into any industry. But what they will bring is that different perspective. Yeah. Oh, well, we do things slightly different over here. We talk about it different ways. We use apps instead of, you know, paper risk assessments. They'll bring something new. So, yeah, preaching to the converted as always. But hands get tied.
I remember
by clients, unfortunately.
I remember applying for the job I'm in now, and I remember seeing the application and it said experience required, and it just listed off like loads of different industries. And
oh, really?
Like,
that's good.
I was like, this is interesting. Maybe this is the one job that I've been working towards all these years. You know, maybe my diversity is not going to hinder me this time. And then as I realized, as the trade association, because we are a weird kind of trade association, really, in that we represent the entire supply chain. So manufacturers all the way down to sole traders, it was actually then a benefit because they wanted so, you know, if I'd have only worked in construction, I wouldn't have had very much understanding or kind of empathy for the challenges of manufacturing and vice versa, which was really interesting. But to your point, Laura, I've never seen that before. It's always been
it's
must
unusual.
Have manufacturing and then we'll maybe consider something else. But you're right, manufacturing is one of the worst.
It is changing. And I think the pandemic has had an impact on that. Absolutely. You know, all the clients I'm talking to at the moment, we're really pushing them because it's a tough market to move people. You know, people have been through a really harrowing 12 months. They've, you know, in health and safety, usually been treated quite well. So they want to stay put. They don't want to move. So we're saying to clients, you have to be more flexible. You just have to. Yeah. And you're going to have to trust us that we're going to look at competencies. We're going to look at culture and we're going to find you the right match. But they may not come from your nearest competitor 10 miles down the road. It's just the way it is at the moment.
But that's about a CEO trying to limit the risk.
It is, of course,
quite clearly when you bring someone into a business at a senior level, you do the absolute best. It takes quite a long time to recruit. And secondly, you want to make certain you're bringing someone in that's going to hit the ground running. Because quite often you've recruited because the person that was there before has gone. Often that can be unexpected. You know, I mean, even if you've got someone locked into a contract and they walk in and go, right, you know, I'm going to go. So even if you've got them a 3-month notice period, you know, you're going to be lucky to get someone in before they walk out the door.
And so,
you know, you don't want someone walking in who's never been in a food factory in their life, has just come from making steel girders and says, well, okay, I'm not exactly where I'm going to start here. So that's about CEOs minimizing the risk. But I don't disagree with you that I think it's really important to get people in that look at your business in a different way. Because they might just look at it in a way that you'd never done before and make some massive improvements.
Yeah.
You know, so that goes for any skill, really.
So I've got a question for you off the back of that then, Richard, because that's a really interesting point that you bring up. And I think the second you said it, I was like, yeah, that's spot on. They're minimising the risk because, and I suppose, you know, I can't remember who told me this. I think it was my wife, but recruiting someone actually costs so much more than just the salary. Like,
God, it does. Yeah.
It's like double the salary or something like that. I can't remember.
In terms of time and effort and all of that.
Then fees and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Like that. So you're trying to minimize that risk. You're spending a hell of a lot of money on this and you get what? An application, a CV and a couple of interviews. So how do we kind of solve that problem in a way? Like, and that's a huge question for me to ask you, Richard, but this is quite a nice little rabbit hole considering we've got safety professional, CEO and a recruiter in a call. You know, would we have, if we're ever going to solve a problem, it's now.
I think it's a really difficult one, James. You know, I'd like to say that there is a scientific approach to it, but there's not. Laura, I hope you semi agree with me.
I completely agree. If I could get an algorithm to get it right, I'd be a millionaire.
You'll do all your checks. You know, you'll ask them questions that relate to their industry, and you know, how would you solve this and that. You do all that, but ultimately, it comes down to gut feel.
I'm
such a big believer in gut feeling. Like when we're recruiting people for our clients, we have a very, very thorough process. We go through competencies and cultures and all of that and make sure that we're getting the right answers. But there is always still a bit of me that knows in my gut which way it's going to go. And that's just, you know, I've been doing it for 12 years.
Yeah. And you've also got to work on the basis that quite often, I mean, unless you're recruiting for a very large multinational, you're going to be bringing someone into what is a relatively small team.
Even
at a board level. So, you know, let's say, you know, an average, you know, company might have sort of 6 board members, right? So you're going to be bringing someone in. You've got to make certain they fit culturally.
Oh, 100%.
You know, I mean, you know, round pegs and square holes don't work. Yeah. And so you've got to make certain they fit with the rest of the board. Even if they're coming at a senior management level, you've got to make certain they fit within the rest of the management team.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, going further down the scale, I've always recruited for attitude rather than skill.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that you just said that, Richard. I think I've been having conversations recently about this, and that, you know what, I feel like I'd be a recruiter's worst nightmare if I was recruiting someone,
Because
I feel like I would, because they'll be like, right, what are you after? And I'll be like, I don't care about Nibosh, I don't care about Ayash, I don't care about any of that stuff. But what I want is attitude. I want a good attitude. I want to sit in a room with them. And this may be, I get this is controversial, and I get for a CEO, this would be like, huh? You don't want any kind of, obviously I do. Like, obviously the qualification, I get that. But for me, I would rather employ in my team somebody from a safety point of view that is underqualified, but has a passion and has a good positive attitude and is a cultural fit, because I can work on their skills and I can work on their qualifications.
The only problem I'd have with that, James, is that you would need to recruit them to a certain level, because if you did put them in a role of health and safety and something went wrong and the health and safety executive came in and to look at your business and said, you've just recruited someone who actually wasn't qualified to do the job you've put them in, you may have a slight problem in life.
Oh, I get that. But
I take your point that it depends where you bring them in at.
I completely agree with that point. Yeah. The problem is the way that we qualify people in the safety profession, in my humble opinion, it doesn't make a safety professional.
Okay.
You can have a Nibosh general and you can be... I've seen people that are IOSH chartered fellow and... Mm-hmm. They're terrible safety professionals. Okay. And I've seen people that are great safety professionals that are chartered fellows. And I've seen people that wouldn't even register. I was talking to a marketing professional the other day. I was actually on a panel with a marketing professional, Global Series, Laura.
I saw it.
And she was outstanding. And in the preamble meeting we had, she was talking away. And she was like, oh, I'm not a safety professional. And I'm like, I beg to differ based on the last half an hour conversation I've had with you.
Yeah.
She would not qualify to be a safety professional in any way, shape or form, but she was damn better than a lot of safety professionals I've spoken to.
Well, luckily for you guys, I sit smack bang in the middle of, of those opinions. So I completely agree with both sides. And the thing that I really push with my clients is, like I said earlier, the flexibility on it is I agree. We cannot be so prescriptive to say I will only speak to chartered members of IOSH from a manufacturing background, you know, with 20 years experience. They're the only people I will speak to. We cannot be that prescriptive. However, Richard, I also completely agree that there has to be a level of qualification.
I think in certain areas, you know, you have to have a competence.
But exactly.
I don't disagree with you, James. I think bringing someone in that perhaps isn't as fully qualified as you'd like, but seeing the right attitude, is absolutely, they are the people that make businesses.
That tends to be where we land.
And you know, I mean, I've met the I've met sort of a lot of technical people in my life, especially auditors around factories, mostly food safety, and I've met them that you wouldn't let in the door. I've also met them that you think, God, I wish I could employ you.
Yeah.
You're really good at what you do, and it's about attitude.
Yeah, 100%. We massively go for culture first, and then we look at the qualification side.
That's about the fit, isn't it?
It's about the fit, yeah, exactly.
They've got to fit. If they don't fit...
They've got to fit.
Yeah,
100%. Yeah. And then if you're looking for diploma, but they've got the right fit and maybe they're studying diploma or, you know, they've gone a different route, that's okay.
Yeah.
But... I think it's that middle ground of they have to be qualified to a certain extent, but we can be flexible about how qualified, which route, as long as the fit is there. So,
Do you find, Laura, that there's a bigger challenge now with automation coming into more and more industry? The safety professionals have got to get their head around what that actually means for a business.
Yeah,
manufacturing.
I mean, yeah. I mentioned earlier that I was a non-exec director at Stateside, and after I'd left the group, I went back to visit them because they're still friends of mine, and they took me around the factory and they just put automatic palletizers in.
Right, yeah, I'm with you. Yeah.
Totally revolutionized that end of the business, but I'm sure brought a lot of issues for the health and safety people because of the way they run.
We actually did a, I think I spoke on it actually at IOSH conference a couple of years ago about the fourth industrial revolution and what that means, how that's going to impact the safety world. And yeah, 100%. But this is, again, to me, why that soft skill side of it is important, because you've got to be able to adapt, because things are going to change now at a crazy, crazy rate. You mentioned things accelerating earlier. Yeah. And that's what we're finding, particularly with technology. It's suddenly growing exponentially. The way that the workplace has changed is now, that's accelerated those sorts of plans. Everything is changing constantly. Yeah. So, yes, it absolutely will impact. But I think it's an exciting place to be for the right professional.
And this has the right attitude. This is interesting, because this has gone down the point that I had previously about qualifications. So the way we currently train our safety professionals is very focused on each individual component, each technical individual component. Understand the ins and outs of this process, of this process, of this process, and so on. And I actually think we let ourselves down, because actually, if we focus on the fundamentals of what we're trying to do here, which is understand work, assess risk, interpret legislation and professional and expert guidance, and then combine all three of those together and communicate that out to the workforce and make sure that it works. If we focus on those four kind of things, or maybe a bit more, which are inherently got foundations in the softer side of skills, give or take the risk of, you know, good risk management and interpreting legislation and understanding law, I cast them as technical. Actually, the technical skills that we've got, what are they? Like, my technical skills have all come from talking to the shop floor, who are the actual experts on the technical skills, the people that have worked with those palletizers or worked with the machine. They're the technical experts. And then taking what they've told me and reading the ACOP and the legislation and going, where do these two worlds merge together? Yeah. Yes, they do merge together here, but this is not merging. They go back to the shop floor and say, what about this bit? How do we think? If we focus on those, then actually, in my opinion, we become so much more dynamic, and any of those digitalizations or any kind of, you know, AI or any new risk that comes up, we become much more dynamic to be able to pivot to those, because COVID, for example, is no different from any other risk in the business. It just means we need to learn specifically about that risk in that moment and how that impacts us there, and off we go. So we focus on interpreting legislation, interpreting guidance, understanding our business, and having the soft skills to communicate it back out to the business and make sure that it works.
Yeah. But isn't the challenge, though, James, when that technology is new into a factory?
Sorry, say that again.
Isn't the challenge when that technology is new into the factory, that you don't have the shop floor experience to go to, that then you've got to rely upon the information that comes from the service provider, the people that actually install that? Quite often they can be overseas. So, for instance, the automatic palletizers that have come from Italy.
Yeah, and that's where I think the shift of us going from being perceived as experts to actually being perceived as facilitators. Like, my job in that.
Yep, that's a good point. Yes.
Facilitate the expert and the shop floor staff, the person that's going to be working on that palletizer, and go, right, what does this product do? Can you tell my guys? And my guys turn around, or girls, and turn around and say back to this expert, how does this work? I facilitate that process and make sure that the legislation works as well. Yeah. So for me, I don't see me as an expert in any way, shape, or form. Yeah. I'm a facilitator.
Yeah. For me, it's also about it being more holistic and getting safety built into the procurement side of things. Because then when you're looking at supply chain and you're looking at bringing these sorts of things in, it's already part of the process. You're not bringing these bits of equipment in and starting completely from scratch. It's built into it. So for me, procurement, supply chain, health and safety, I mean, that all goes completely hand in hand.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. Yeah, and all you do there is just ring your safety professional and go, we're thinking about buying this. And
nine times out of 10, it's communication, though, again, isn't it?
Exactly
what we said.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's powerful. Yeah. If you get the shop floor and put them in that design meeting or that procurement meeting, you watch what happens. And I've seen it. We got the operational staff. I'm conscious we're coming up on time as well, but I remember I got the operational staff into a design meeting for a block of flats. And I said, well, I want you to come in this room and talk to the design people. We're building a building. We're going to build it so that it works. We're not going to build ourselves more problems for this operational team and me to help, you know, for us all to deal with. We're going to nail this out before we even start putting bricks and mortar together. You get them in the room. And here's just one example. A huge problem we used to have in Howdham was customers putting shoes and doormats and shoe racks in the communal space, which is a fire escape, right?
Yeah.
Nightmare. Because sometimes a doormat, yeah, take it or leave it, but the doormat becomes your shoe rack, which becomes your shoes, which becomes your kids' toys, which then and airing your laundry out there, it just gets crazy, right? And it's just a weekly thing that operational people in housing deal with all the time. So we get them into the design meeting. How do we fix this problem? And the design team turned around and said, okay, well, let's have a look at the kind of floor that we put. And my role in this process, facilitating it. I'm just asking those open questions. What can you do here? What's this? Tell me about your problem. What about this? I'm playing devil's advocate and just playing with it. And they turn around and they go, well, actually, all of our flats have a really lush carpet on the hallway. And that's it. That's all they have is just this carpet. So no wonder they want to keep their shoes out in the hallway. Okay, so can we do something about that, design team? Well, yeah, we can give them hardware. We can give them a big mat well. We can give them loads of stuff. We just solved one of our biggest problems in Howden just by getting the right people in the right room and asking some open questions.
It all harks back to something Richard said right at the beginning, which was about people working in silos and why that doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And that's something, you know, James, you and I have talked about this a lot. Health and safety people previously, we did used to sort of silo ourselves off. And that's just not something we can do moving forward for this exact reason. It's all about, communication. Keyword for the day. There you go.
I'm conscious we've come up on time and we got to shoot. So is there any kind of closing thoughts you want to say before you say bye and give us a shout out to your company? Any kind of closing thoughts on our conversation?
Richard?
Either of you. Any kind of thoughts that you thought?
Well, ladies go first.
For me, look, we kind of kept saying it, but it's interesting that every conversation we're kind of having is coming back to the key things about us being more open, about us sharing best practice, sharing innovation, having those conversations, changing the way we approach things. That's just huge for me. That's the way we have to do things moving forward to be able to make the industry better in any way at all. And this conversation, I thoroughly enjoyed this. I think we could have talked about this for about 3 hours quite easily. So I really appreciate you coming on, Richard. If you want to give us a shout out, to your company. And
I tell you what, I'll make one comment to sum up. When I talked to Simon, my health and safety lead, I asked him what are the key things that is needed in the health and safety world today. And he said to be agile.
Perfect.
To think differently. So look, thanks very much for allowing me to come on. The British Frozen Food Federation, we're a bit like James's Federation. We're a bit different. Our members are very varied. So we've got all the big retailers. So some of the big retailers, people like Asda, Iceland, Aldi. We've got manufacturers, people like Nomad, right down to small companies, small one-man bands. So the only common thing is they all sell frozen food. We're a fantastically diverse industry. We are an industry that has the ability to help the environment. We can reduce food wastage in an amazing way, whether it's a consumer or whether it is a professional kitchen. But I think one of the challenges that all of our members face is there is going to be more and more legislation, whether that's around health and safety, whether that's around packaging, whether that's around environmental concerns. And I think that's the role that federations play, that we can help and support our members face those challenges. So that's the end of the advert for the BFFF. If you're interested,
very well sold.
please look us up. We'd be delighted to talk to anyone who's in the frozen food family. Thank you.
No, that's great. Thank you both. And not to give another advert to another trade association, but just actually to give an advert to trade associations in general. I never really considered them at all in my entire career, unless I wanted some really specific industry advice about something. Until I worked at one, and now working at one, the power of them, or not power, the potential is a better word, the potential of a trade association, the potential of the community that you can build being a member of the trade association, for me, is underrated in our country. And I think actually the potential I see that we could have and the other trade associations like the BFF, British
BFFF, try saying it on stage when you're trying to do a presentation. Really difficult.
BFFF. and all the others out there, they do some amazing work. And actually, the power of getting to your point, Richard, to getting loads of different diverse members in a room talking about one problem, be it the environment, sustainability, waste, recycling. That's how you solve problems, is getting diverse people in a room and say, how can we as an industry fix this problem? You get them together. And I'm so impressed with the power of trade association. I just hope that we take them more seriously. They're not old men in smoking jackets anymore. They're potential communities that can drive change.
Well, I don't know. I'm old.
Have you still got your smoking jacket?
No.
Thank you very much for both of your time. Sorry about my little soapbox for trade associations. Right. I think they've got a lot of potential. So thank you, Richard, and thank you again, Laura. Laura, do you want to give us a quick, very, very quick insight in who we're having next?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll do it very speedily. It's a gentleman called Paul Ryder, who's coming on the next episode. He is the CEO of Government Facilities Services Limited. So it's a government-led FM services company. So just a completely different perspective again from Janet in the first one, from Richard in this one. And yeah, fantastic guy again, really charismatic. So I think we'll go on completely different rabbit holes with Paul. So looking forward to it.
Thank you very much. And thank you both for your time.
Okay, peeps, hope you enjoyed that episode. That was a penultimate episode of The Quarterly Co-Host. Got one more to come from Laura. And then next month, when we have our Quarterly Co-Host, I'll tell you what's coming up on the next one as well. But for now, I'll catch you later. Don't forget to check out Paradigm Human Performance, HSC subscription service, website in the description below. Don't forget to check out projectmiletium.com or message me if you want a free trial for one of our calls. Don't forget, if you want some more work from us, a Rebranding Safety, go to www.rebrandingsafety.com. We can help you with podcasts, with webinars. We can help you with any form of safety media. Just drop us a message. But if you want something different for your event, like it blogging, or you want to have a keynote, we can do that for you as well. Or maybe you're selling a brand, you're selling a service, and you want a bespoke video for that. You want to do some influencer marketing, then why not come to Rebranding Safety? I'll catch you next week. Safe.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only based on limited and dated open source information and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.